I'm Veronica Dudo. Tonight on EWTN News Nightly, U.S. delegation. Despite recent violence, a fragile ceasefire still holds in the Middle East. And today, Vice President J.D. Vance lands in Israel. We have the latest. Dubious honor, the somber milestone the government shutdown reached today, and the effects it's having on the economy. Plus, the winning bid, a motorcycle signed by Pope Leo XIV, is auctioned off, how much it brought in, and where the money's going. These stories and more tonight.
From EWTN, the Global Catholic Network, this is EWTN News Nightly.
Thank you for being with us on the feast of Blessed Karl of Austria. Our top story tonight, President Donald Trump says there is still hope that Hamas will do what is right. Otherwise, he says, an end to Hamas will be fast, furious, and brutal. His comments come as Vice President J.D. Vance arrives in Israel to review Gaza's fragile ceasefire. Vance calls it a very tough situation, but he also believes things are going better than expected, adding there is a lot of work left to do. White House correspondent Owen Jensen reports. Owen.
Veronica, good evening to you. Vice President J.D. Vance at a news conference told reporters he has great optimism that the ceasefire will hold. He also cautioned there will be hills and valleys, and he asked the Prince of Peace for help.
In Gaza, the U.S. brokered deal interrupted with outbreaks of deadly violence and questions over how to move forward. On Truth Social, President Donald Trump writes, numerous of our now great allies in the Middle East and areas surrounding the Middle East have explicitly and strongly, with great enthusiasm, informed me that they would welcome the opportunity at my request to go into Gaza with a heavy force and straighten out Hamas if Hamas continues to act badly in violation of their agreement with us. And at a newly opened center in Israel for civilian and military cooperation aimed at keeping the U.S.-backed ceasefire plan on track, Vice President J.D. Vance addressed reporters.
There is this weird attitude I've sensed in the American media and the Western media where there's almost this desire to root for failure, that every time something bad happens, that every time that there's an act of violence, there's this inclination to say, oh, this is the end of the ceasefire. This is the end of the peace plan. It's not the end.
The ceasefire took effect October 10th. Vice President Vance is optimistic it will hold.
And I'd ask all people of faith, in particular my fellow Christians, to pray that the Prince of Peace can continue to work a miracle in this region of the world. I think that we have made incredible strides over the past week. We're going to have to make a lot more, but I think with your prayers, with God's providence, and with a very good team behind me, I think we're going to get it done.
Along with the Vice President, Middle East Envoy Steve Witkoff, and President Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, one of the architects of the ceasefire agreement. Witkoff said he and Jared earlier met with 10 hostages and their families.
And it was really an emotional moment. And I felt blessed to be in that room. Lots of tears, lots of people really, really grateful to President Trump for getting their children home.
Kushner told reporters it is possible to create something better in Gaza.
I want to echo what the Vice President said about how a lot of people are getting a little hysterical about different incursions one way or the other. But what we are seeing is that things are going in accordance. Both sides are transitioning from 2 years of very intense warfare to now a peacetime posture.
In addition, today, Vice President Vance emphasized the American people should know that U.S. troops will not be on the ground in Gaza. At the White House, Owen Jensen, EWTN News Nightly.
Now we'd like to bring on Dr. Jonathan Schanzer, Executive Director of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. Welcome.
Thank you.
While the ceasefire is a breakthrough, what are the biggest risks to the stability and durability of the agreement?
Well, I think we had a couple things right now. One is that Hamas doesn't return the remaining hostages. There are 14 slain hostages that Israel is expecting, and Hamas appears to be slow rolling their return. The Israelis are showing patience right now at the behest of the United States, and so we'll continue to watch that very carefully. After that, will Hamas want to disarm? I think that is a huge risk here, that they will not want to do so. This is a terrorist organization that has been around since 1988. They have a long history of fighting and reinventing themselves. I think we should expect them to continue in that vein. And then I think, look, beyond that, I've got one other major concern, and that is that two of the actors that have been brought in to be guarantors of this agreement are actually really not trustworthy. I'm speaking here specifically about the countries of Qatar and Turkey. They were patrons of Hamas throughout this war. They have been housing Hamas operatives on their soil. In fact, their patronage of Hamas goes back 15, 20 years, both of them. And now we're asking them to play a role in post-Hamas Gaza. I'm not sure we can trust that. But look, despite all of these challenges, I think we should acknowledge the fact that Donald Trump has done something that no one thought was possible, that we are now close or closer to a more permanent ceasefire. I don't know if it can hold, but I think even getting to where we are is a significant achievement for the president.
Is there oversight for those guarantors? Do we know yet?
Well, right now, I think it is. There's a lot that has yet to be answered. There's supposed to be an international force, an international transitional authority that's supposed to take over the Gaza Strip once we get out of phase one. But phase one would include the return of the rest of these hostages, the 14 bodies, as well as the dismantling of Hamas, to have Hamas voluntarily disarm. So after that, I think comes the hard work of trying to assemble those actors that would be involved. Again, we hear that Turkey and Qatar will be there. They would get oversight, perhaps, from countries like Egypt or Indonesia or Saudi Arabia or the United Arab Emirates. And, of course, the United States is set to have something like 200 advisors, not boots on the ground, but they would be there to help ensure a more orderly process.
Now, you previously worked as a terrorism finance analyst at the U.S. Department of the Treasury, having followed and froze the funding of terror groups. Can you explain why this is critical and also effective for counterterrorism?
Well, look, all of these groups, they operate with money. They have to. And they need the dollars in order to be able to pay their operatives, to be able to buy weapons, to be able to buy the materials that they use for, you know, in Hamas's case, the terror tunnels, the cement and everything. All of this stuff requires money. So the more that we can inhibit their activities by freezing those assets, the better off we're going to be. But look, this is, it's not a hermetic solution to the problem. It is a way of throwing up roadblocks, if you will, for a terrorist organization. They will find ways around what we do, but it's a non-kinetic way of making life more difficult for terrorist organizations. And the Treasury still does it today, and they're doing terrific work.
Dr. Jonathan Shanzer, thank you so much.
Pleasure.
Potential plans for President Trump to meet with Russian President Putin have been shelved. Last week, President Trump said the two leaders would hold talks in Budapest, Hungary, but an administration official now says there are no plans for a summit in the immediate future. So far, the White House has not said why the meeting was put on hold, but it stresses that Trump is still committed to brokering peace in Ukraine. The government shutdown has now reached 21 days, tied for the second longest in U.S. history. The parties remain in a standoff over health care subsidies, and a vote on a GOP funding bill failed again in the Senate last night. Meanwhile, the economic effects continue to ripple through the economy. Capitol Hill correspondent Eric Rosales reports. Eric.
Well, good evening, Veronica. There is a growing sense up here on Capitol Hill that the shutdown could last into November. That would mean hardships to millions of people, especially our U.S. military and even farmers. Senate Republicans went to the White House today not to talk about how to end this impasse, but for a display of unity with President Trump. Afterwards, Senate Majority Leader John Thune said the president is on board with congressional Republicans' efforts to open the government.
I think he wants the Democrats to take yes for an answer. We've offered them a lot of the things they were asking for, a normal appropriations process, an opportunity to get a vote on some of the things that they want to see voted on with respect to the expiring Obamacare enhanced subsidies. But that can't happen until they open up the government.
Democrats continue to say nothing will happen until Republicans reverse cuts to Medicaid and extend Obamacare subsidies that are set to expire on January 1st.
House Republicans continue to behave as nothing more than reckless rubber stamps for Donald Trump's extreme agenda that's hurting the American people.
Senate Democrats have blocked the House pass funding bill 11 times.
But Republicans continue to act like these ACA premiums are not their problems. They're the problem of the American people, and they're a problem of every legislator, Democrat and Republican.
This week, Senate Majority Leader John Thune hopes to pass a bill to fund the military and other first responders, replacing President Trump's temporary order to pay the military out of existing DOD funds.
It is very short term. This will not last through the long term. So, yes, we need to make sure through Congress that we are appropriating the dollars for military pay, the Department of Defense, also for the Coast Guard, and I would look at other essential workers as well.
Both sides are also urging President Trump to open up farm loans during the shutdown. Senator Peter Welch says Trump's bailout of Argentina, along with his new tariffs, are destroying growers.
Scott Bessent is a billionaire who appears to be dedicating his treasury life to wrecking the farm economy. We've got to get purchasing power up in our farm communities.
Alabama Senator Tommy Tuberville says the suicide rate among farmers has now passed that of veterans.
We have more farmers now taking their own lives because they're proud people. They love the country. They love their family. They love their communities, but they can't pay their bills.
Lawmakers tell me that they will probably have to pass another continuing resolution shortly because the fast approaching November 1st expiration date of the first one doesn't give them enough time to be able to pass appropriation bills. But House Speaker Mike Johnson says lawmakers are working on spending bills right now, so they're going to be ready once the government reopens. But when that'll be, only time will tell. At the Capitol, Eric Rosales, EWTN News Nightly.
Jim Ennis, the executive director of Catholic Rural Life, joins me now. Thank you so much for your time.
Hi, Veronica. It's my pleasure.
So let's begin with what we just heard with Eric's reporting and those lawmakers talking about the shutdown, how it's impacting farm subsidies. How important are those subsidies?
Farmers work on very thin margins. So the subsidies do provide a buffer, especially when prices are low and input costs are very high. The tariffs have caused input costs to almost double, increase 50, 100% for farmers. Now, the price of soybeans has always gone up and down, but when your input costs go up that significantly, your margins are even thinner. So these subsidies are really important to help protect and provide a safety net for farmers.
China is weaponizing soybeans to squeeze American farmers and spite President Trump as trade talks continue. What are you hearing from farmers impacted by this situation?
Well, I was just talking to a farmer this afternoon, and that, you know, China is a very big market. Farmers are nervous about the future markets in China. If America's farmers lose China as a market, China can go to Brazil or maybe Argentina. And U.S. markets, they'll lose that long-term market, and that could have a very significant impact on the health and wealth of farmers in the United States. So they're very concerned about opening up trade with China.
Soybean farmers across America are in the middle of their annual harvest, but they're seemingly watching about 25% of their market vanish with China buying elsewhere. Are there any opportunities to find alternative markets?
You know, the price of soybeans right now has stabilized. I was talking to this farmer I mentioned earlier, and he sold some of his soybeans right now that will be eventually delivered next year. So farmers are locking in prices, and some farmers are waiting, hoping that the price will increase down the road. But that's a gamble. And so there's opportunity for other markets possibly. But right now, China is, like you say, 25% of the market. So farmers are really nervous about the future of their soybean crops. So it's a big concern. And farmers are also looking for subsidies to help support them in this very difficult time.
Well, we'll continue to follow the story. Jim Ennis, thank you so much.
Thank you, Veronica.
NASA, the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, is also one of the many federal agencies affected by the government shutdown. The Assistant Chief for Technology spoke to us in a personal capacity about the impact on space operations.
In general, we can see that, well, the industry is experiencing a bit of a slowdown, considering that many employees in the government are not working right now. Although many of them, I think, are probably forward funded and are still able to carry on some of the work that they have been doing. But in general, not having the government involved directly during the lapse of funding, clearly there is a bit of a slowdown.
While dozens of projects have been paused, essential missions like the International Space Station and satellite operations are among the few still functioning. Additionally, the president's budget request for fiscal year 2026 includes a 25% cut to NASA's funding. We have a lot more still to come on EWTN News Nightly, a historic first in Japan. Who is the nation's first ever female prime minister and why her views are already making headlines? And a revealing new study on Catholic priests. We speak with one of the lead authors. A new study released this month takes a look at the overall well-being of Catholic priests and certain trends in their thinking. It was published by the Catholic Project at the Catholic University of America. The authors examined everything from the quality of life of the priest to their opinions, as well as trust of the bishops and the Holy Father, Pope Leo XIV. Joining us now is one of the authors of the study, Dr. Brandon Vaidyanathan. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Sure. Happy to be here.
So first, you conducted this kind of study in 2022, and then this year you did it again. What kind of changes did you see, if any?
Yeah, we tried to understand how priests are doing over time. This is the first longitudinal study of Catholic priests, and so we wanted to see how priests have changed in terms of their well-being, burnout, trust in bishops. And we do find modest improvements. So their well-being is, we have one indicator of well-being, what we call the sort of flourishing index. So they're overall flourishing, and that's not really changed over time. They're doing really well. Their burnout levels have actually improved. So priests are doing well, better in 2025 than they were in 2022. And their trust in bishops has also gone up slightly.
Now, what were some of the positive signs, in addition to what you just mentioned, that you saw from the study?
A lot of hope in Pope Leo, which we think is a good sign. The other big finding is, we'd asked priests about their views on the synod, on synodality, and on the actual process of the synod, they're quite ambivalent. But when it comes to the practices, whatever synodality might indicate, we tried to measure that. And we looked at a number of indicators, the extent to which they're delegating authority, making decisions in consultation with parishioners, et cetera. And the vast majority of priests are doing that. So they're really walking the synodal way, even if the term synodality might be, a little bit suspect to some of them.
What was the inspiration behind this study? And also, tell us a little bit more about why you decided to do it.
Our initial motivation was when the then president of our university, John Garvey, was in discussion with a senior leader in the church, and he had expressed this cardinal had expressed that a lot of priests seem to be worried that if they go to their bishops with any sort of concern about their ability to perform their ministry effectively, they would be thrown under the bus, they would not be helped, they would be seen as a liability. And so we wanted to really assess empirically, through a nationally representative study, what percentage of priests are actually worried about, the extent to which they'd be taken seriously by their bishops, the extent to which their bishops would help them, et cetera. And so in that study in 2022, we found that 82% of priests live with a constant fear of false accusation of sexual abuse, and only a small percentage of them thought that if they went to their bishops for help, they would actually be helped. And so that was really alarming. But then we also tracked their individual well-being. We found that despite these concerns about the trust that they had in their bishops, they had pretty low levels of trust. When it came to their personal well-being, they were doing really well. And so we really wanted to assess over time, are any of these indicators changing? Is their well-being improving or declining? Are their burnout levels changing over time? Are they more trusting of their bishops now than they used to be, et cetera. And so that was the motivation for the follow-up study.
Now, one particular area of the study was on loneliness of the priesthood. What did you find?
Yeah, we did try to see how priests are doing in terms of their close social relationships with other priests, with lay people, et cetera. And we find that using one prominent measure of loneliness, a UCLA scale, something like 40% of priests are experiencing loneliness. And that is, it sounds alarming, but you know, the general population levels are actually much higher. So priests overall are doing better than the average member of the American public.
Very fascinating study, Dr. Brandon Vaidyanathan. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Turning now to a historic first in Japan, Sanae Takaichi is elected as the country's first female prime minister.
As a result, the House has elected Sanae Takaichi as the prime minister.
A known ultra-conservative, she stands up for supporting male-only imperial succession and opposes same-sex marriage. Takaichi appoints only two women ministers, despite a pledge to drastically increase the number of women in the cabinet. The 64-year-old takes power after months of political uncertainty and just ahead of a planned visit from U.S. President Donald Trump. Former French President Nicolas Sarkozy begins his five-year prison sentence in Paris today after being convicted of criminal conspiracy. President from 2007 to 2012, he was convicted for financing his 2007 presidential campaign with funds from Libya. Hundreds of supporters gathered outside his home as he was escorted to prison. This is the first time a leader of modern France has been incarcerated. Up next on EWTN News Nightly, Religious Freedom. A newly released report details the religious freedom of Christians around the world. Now one organization is pushing to make a change. Plus, what does a motorcycle, Madagascar, and the Pope have in common? We'll tell you how a special auction connected all three. Six months ago today, the Universal Catholic Church received some somber news.
Carissimi fratelli e sorelle,
dear brothers and sisters, with deep sorrow, I must announce the death of our Holy Father, Francis.
On April 21st, Cardinal Kevin Farrell announced to the world that Pope Francis had returned to the House of the Father. The 88-year-old had been battling bronchitis in the weeks leading up to his death. Pope Francis was the first Jesuit and Latin American to serve as Supreme Pontiff elected to the office in 2013. Eternal rest grant unto him, O Lord, and let perpetual light shine upon him. Today, the Catholic organization Aid to the Church in Need presented the 2025 Religious Freedom Report. During the opening remarks, Cardinal Secretary of State Pietro Parolin said that the religious freedom is a fundamental aspect of human existence. EWTN Vatican News correspondent Valentina Di Donato has more.
It is important to note, however, that religious freedom should not be considered an unchecked absolute.
So says Vatican Secretary of State Pietro Parolin, speaking to a group of bishops, priests, and laypeople.
Rather, it is a dynamic equilibrium bounded by wisdom and equity. In any given era of culture, the practical boundaries must be discerned through political prudence.
Cardinal Parolin was speaking at the presentation of the Religious Freedom in the World report, published by the Aid to the Church in Need. Ahead of the report's release, Pope Leo XIV also emphasized the importance of religious freedom. In an audience held with members of the Pontifical Foundation of Aid to the Church in Need International, he noted the rising hostilities and violence against those who hold different convictions, including Christians. One of the places affected most by violence toward Christians is Nigeria. Catholic Secretariat officials wonder why the violence and killings are not given the attention that they deserve.
Nigeria is still bleeding, but we must place this bleeding in context. I think what we now need is a robust strategy for engagement. And we in Nigeria must also come to terms with the fact that this mess belongs to us. We thank ACN, we thank a lot of other international brothers and sisters who continue to work along with us. But the heavy lifting must be done by us in Nigeria. This is why I think that we need a strategy of engagement.
Regina Lynch is the executive president of Aid to the Church in Need. The organization is now launching a petition to make freedom of religion recognized as a human right.
freedom of religion is not just a privilege, it's a human right. And we just see the situation worsening in the world. The idea really is that every man and woman of goodwill can sign this petition to demand that religious freedom is our human right, and that we respect that, and it's possible for everybody.
Cardinal Parolin agrees, saying that such a right would greatly improve societies worldwide.
Collectively, it fosters vibrant communities where people of different faith can live together, contribute to society, and engage in constructive dialogue without fear of persecution. For this right to be realized, it must be formally recognized within legal frameworks. It should be enshrined as a fundamental civil right in constitutions, domestic laws, and international treaties.
In Rome, Valentina Di Donato for EWTN News Nightly.
Signed, sealed, and delivered, but we are not talking about the Stevie Wonder song. Last month, the Jesus Biker Group brought Pope Leo a white BMW motorcycle. Pope Leo not only signed it, he sat on it. It was recently auctioned off in Munich for 130,000 euros. All the proceeds benefit the Catholic aid organization Missio Austria. The money is specifically intended for children in Madagascar who work under slave-like conditions in mines. We thank you for watching tonight. Remember, you can follow us on social media, Facebook, X, and Instagram at EWTN News Nightly. I'm Veronica Dudo. Good night and God bless.